Our first case today is Erickson v. The Wisconsin Department of Corrections, number 054516. And it's Mr. Moriarty.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. Initially, Judge Evans, I wish to apologize for my last case before you, and if you could convey that to the panel in that case before. Message heard and will be heeded. May it please the Court. Repeatedly over the past two decades, this Court has confirmed that employers cannot be held liable for non-supervisory sexual harassment under Title VII unless the employer has notice of harassment and then fails to properly respond. When an employer does have notice of
I just want to make certain I understand your argument. Are you arguing that even if an employer knows of a risk of sexual harassment, it is not liable unless there is a prior act of harassment? In other words, the employer can ignore the risk until there is an incident of sexual harassment. Is that your argument?
That is the message that comes out of how I read this circuit's law, that the duty is to prevent further harassment. That's the way the court has phrased it, to prevent harassment from recurring. And so there must be an incident of prior harassment before there is liability for non-supervisory harassment.
Okay.
Yes. And this has been articulated in dozens of cases since 1986 when the court first articulated that standard. And it's used the phrase, the duty is to prevent further harassment in numerous cases, to prevent harassment from recurring in numerous cases.
And that's regardless of how egregious, horrendous the harassment may be.
There is an exception here, and that is where, and for example, in the Turnbull case, provides a good example. In Turnbull, the atmosphere of sexual hostility was so pervasive that a prior act of harassment was unnecessary. In other words, it was any employer would know that this was such a sexually charged atmosphere that you don't have to have actual acts of prior harassment. But this isn't a constructive notice case at all. This was a situation where you had a minimum security facility with inmates that had been reviewed, classified, and determined to be capable of working in almost a campus setting, going out on work release.
But there were very strict rules, and they were not to be in certain areas at certain times of the day. And here, Spicer, I guess his name, was in a prohibited area at a prohibited time. And it just seems to me that that's really should set up red flares that there is a potential for a problem here. And it seems to me that this is a very simple, there's a very simple solution to this, unlike the typical non-supervisor harassment cases where you have to, somebody's been working on the job for a long time, so you have to find out whose story is right or who's wrong.
Civil service,
here, all you
all
have
that,
to do is reclassify the inmate for being in this area at the wrong time, and it would never have happened.
That's absolutely correct, that the ability to move those inmates is untampered. The Institute and Johnson, Captain Johnson, had in fact done that with the prior inmate. There was a complaint from Cheryl Shushart. This individual is talking too much about family affairs, and Johnson said, fine, we're reassigning him. Had nothing to do with harassment, but they reassigned him. But the issue here of the timeliness is an important one, or whether he had authority to be there on time is an important one. The record reflects that there was no rule that he could not be there after 4:30. If he was still performing tasks, He was allowed, the testimony reflected, to be there and complete his task.
But there is evidence in the record, other than Spicer's presence, of inmates being in those offices after 4:30?
There was evidence that there was no firm rule that they had to be gone by 4:30. I believe, I can't recall which witness it was, but as a general matter, there was no prohibition against them being there at 4:30.
Well, but would an inmate in the office after the doors were locked at 4:30 have been able to leave without assistance?
If it had been locked, no. Obviously, then the inmate doesn't have keys and would have to be let out without. Someone would have to let him out. No question about it.
Just to be completely clear, was there any policy about when inmate janitors should not be in the work areas of the employees? Was there any policy?
Yes. Yes, there was. If, for example, this janitor was assigned to the office, he could be in the office. An inmate who was not assigned to be in the office had no authority to be in that office. And if sometimes inmates, for example, might be assigned to go and move some furniture, they'd have a guard with them go, and they'd move that furniture in the office, then they'd leave. But this was an inmate who was assigned to a job in the office, and his job was to clean the waste baskets, do whatever was needed. Sometimes that occurs after 4:30.
You know, going back to the our previous discussion, by promising Erickson that the encounter with Spicer would never happen again, wasn't Thompson relieving Erickson of a duty to request anything further? I mean, what more notice could Erickson be expected to provide if the warden himself has already promised her this will never happen again?
All right. And obviously there's a conflict, but we have to read it in Erickson's favor. And that's what she testified that Thompson was present and told her. There was no duty on Erickson's part to say anything further, no legal duty. However, the duty on the employer to either remedy harassment or prevent further harassment doesn't arise until they have notice of prior harassment. So it's
we're colliding here a bit, aren't we? I mean, if she has no duty to say anything more, and he has no duty to do anything more.
She has no duty at all. The employer could find out about the harassment from someone other than the employee entirely. The employee has no obligation to inform the employer of the prior harassment incident. So that notice can come from a lot of places. But in a situation...
Just two of you in there.
Well, right. In a situation where the only notice that the employer could conceivably get has to come from the employee, then this court has said the employee does need to provide enough information so that the employer knows prior harassment has occurred. At that point, then we have the two duties arise. And you've got to remedy that harassment, and you've got to prevent further harassment. Remedying harassment can be breached, for example, by putting the employee in a less favorable position in a worse job. You breach that duty to remedy. If you're informed of prior harassment and the employer says, well, I'm not going to do anything about it, and another harassing incident occurs, that's when the liability falls on the employer. In the Doe case, for example, you had a situation, unfortunately, where a rape had occurred before the notice, and the court said, no, you don't have liability for that incident, of which the employer was unaware, a coworker incident.
You know, I was interested in the argument in your reply brief where you said that Erickson's subjective fear of sexual assault and feeling that Spicer was stalking her based on that first encounter was would not be, I think you said, objectively reasonable. And, you know, the Department of Corrections is training its employees like Erickson about inmate fantasies. I mean, isn't that an acknowledgement that a male inmate in close proximity to a female civilian presents an inherent risk of sexual assault? I mean, wouldn't most people consider that that would be a real possibility in the circumstances that she described? He's sort of lurking around.
We have two things that happened. One was at trial, she related what occurred. And then she also related what she notified the supervisors about. And it's very important to recognize what she notified the supervisors about mentioned nothing about stalking, nothing about any sexuality at all, at the bar.
But she testified to their reaction after hearing what she said, and their reaction was, wow, this is their jaws dropped.
And in a situation like that with a supervisor in a corrections setting, hearing this inmate alone and someone's coming and telling you about it, there's the danger of physical assault, there's the danger of theft, there's a danger of a lot of things, but nothing about sexuality. There was no hint of sexuality that was conveyed through this notice. On her perceptions of what she saw at the time and her thinking, I thought he was stalking me, again, that could be physical violence that she was thinking about. It could be any number of things. So, yes, there could be objective, perhaps an objective reasonable standard could be met. I didn't see it there with that, but that is a call that could be made.
And it was by the jury.
Well, the jury had to focus on the notice, the actual words used by her to the supervisors, not what she said she thought happened actually in the incident on December 20th. Oh, I could reserve the rest.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cassietta, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Bob Cassietta for Georgia Erickson. Let me divide my argument, if I may please, basically into three separate areas, the first being some application of the appropriate standard or plaintiff Georgia Erickson's position regarding the appropriate standard. The next, the totality of the circumstances that the Department of Corrections had or was aware of at the various times, and the totality of the facts that apply to the negligence standard. And finally, the implications that the Department of Corrections argues from a policy perspective and what they contend the policy issues are here. Now, we respectfully submit that there need not be any prior actionable harassment to trigger an obligation on the part of an employer for third-party sex harassment liability. And the basis for that is in the law. Counsel properly points out that there are many cases, I think he strung cite 40, which deal with the issues where there was inadequate notice provided by the individual victim of the sexual harassment. That is not this case. In this case, the totality of the circumstances bear upon how corrections should have acted and what they failed to do. Now, I believe that the standard that was articulated regarding the notice requirement in the Cooper Schutt case that we cited is the appropriate standard, and essentially that there was some probability that she was being sexually harassed. Now, some probability, and we went on to cite the Zimmerman case as well there, and the language which the Corrections Department seems to agree under Standard Jury Instruction 3.04, all of which suggest in the broad context that there need not be a complaint from the victim, and all of which also suggest that there is no rule which provides that the employer has no obligations under Title VII unless or until
actionable sexual harassment has already occurred. So we take that standard, I respectfully submit, to what went on in this case and what the Department of Corrections knew in this case at the various times. Now, by way of background, the Department of Corrections knew that one of the things that triggered concern regarding inmate management was increased vigilance by an inmate of staff behavior.
Let me ask you, how crucial is it, or is it absolutely crucial to your case, that the inmate was in this area at a time when he should not have been there?
It's very important. But
would you have a case without that?
Yes. I believe that we would.
So if he came in at an appropriate time and he was emptying waste baskets but kind of looking at her in a what she perceived to be some peculiar way, there would still have been an obligation on the part of the state to act here?
Let me add a few more facts to your hypothetical.
Well, I want you to answer, if you can, mm-hmm. how critical it is for your case that at the precise time that she perceived a danger or something peculiar going on, he was in a place where he shouldn't have been.
I think it's extremely important. Critical suggests to me that it's dispositive, and I'm not sure.
That's what I want to know. Do you think it is?
I don't think it standing alone is a dispositive fact that if absent, we would not prevail. The jury was instructed, and I think the standard fairly applied is, that the totality of the circumstances must be examined. Now, in the circumstance that you describe, Your Honor, it might be that there were other facts that the jury considered to be more important. Without that central fact, which is in the case, that he was in there after hours. Now, the doors lock at 4:30. The inmates do not have keys to those doors. And it is very clear from this record that this inmate was there after hours and should not have been. And that was confirmed by the reaction on December 20th of those supervisors when Georgia Erickson told them that she had these concerns. But going back to the point of whether or not, setting aside that fact, there is the ability to find liability on the part of the employer. It would be a different case, but I would respectfully submit that there is no bright line that says that a certain thing had to happen before an employer would have to act reasonably, and there is no bright line threshold that the employee must cross to give the notice.
Is it your argument that Spicer did sexually harass her during that first encounter?
It is. If he was stalking her, the Gentry case is quite clear that stalking constitutes sexual harassment. But once again, I would come back to the notion that there need not be actionable sexual harassment in the first instance to provide sufficient notice to the employer to impose a duty.
Well, of course, the EEOC regulation contemplates notice of at least one incident of sexual harassment before an employer can be liable for sexual harassment by a third party.
Yeah. And of course, that's not binding. It's instructive.
No, why?
But the Seventh Circuit, in my reading of the cases, has never taken the position that there is an absolute one harassment policy that says that absent that first act of harassment, no liability can attach.
Well, does the unreasonable risk standard that was employed by the district court here, does that appear anywhere in the circuit's precedent?
It does appear, I believe, fairly stated in the context of the way that Judge Posner talked about the duty in the Zimmerman case. If you read what Judge Posner was saying in the Zimmerman case, I respectfully submit he was contemplating, and this court contemplated, that there would be a standard of reasonableness on the front end, if you will, when there was any potential notice here of an obligation on the part of the employer, that employer was held to a reasonable standard. And applying the Zimmerman case and using the language of the district court, in this circumstance, the jury was properly permitted to consider
whether, in fact, the employer had received sufficient information to put it on notice that there was some obligation to act reasonably to prevent further harassment, to accept for the moment the Department of Corrections' articulation of the standard.
What if all the facts here were as they are, except that instead of a correctional setting, this would have been the home office of American Family Insurance in Madison, and a maintenance janitor worker had done what happened here?
Yeah.
Would there be liability?
In that case, in that circumstance, the case probably fails, because the totality of the circumstances here so hinged upon the fact that this was a correctional institution and what the Department of Corrections knew or should have known to apply the negligence standard appropriately about inmate behavior, about prison administration, about the way that these things happen.
But that amounts to essentially a strict liability standard, not a negligence standard in the corrections context, and that's what concerns me about the district court's risk theory here, and making that the rule of law in this circuit makes every correctional institution strictly liable.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because the issue of it being a prison is merely one of the factors that are placed in the weight that goes to the negligence standard. We are not arguing, George Erickson has never argued in the Rule 56 motion, in the Rule 50 motion, that there was strict liability. And in fact, in her decision under the Rule 50 motion, Judge Crabb indicates that she is not intending to apply a strict liability standard. What she is clearly saying, I believe, is that she is applying the reasonable standard on the notice and on the remedy portion of Title VII.
You've got a very unique position for the Department of Corrections here, it seems to me, because they have, or at least theoretically they surely should have, total control over Spicer. And because the prison has set up a system that seems to be inherently risky. And that would separate it, I take it, is your argument from, you know, some sort of global rule.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. We aren't asking that this court, and we never asked the district court, to impose a special rule for prisons or correctional facilities. What we are asking is for the application of the longstanding rule that essentially provides that the totality of the circumstance. Counsel in his first brief indicated that we must be examining the forest, not the trees. I think that's a pretty good analogy in this circumstance, because the totality of the circumstance was placed in front of the jury, and they had to decide what was reasonable, using a reasonable, not a strict liability standard. Now, let me, if I may please, talk just briefly about those issues, those facts that were before the Department of Corrections, or that provide the overview, the gloss, for the entirety of this case. DOC, as I indicated, knew that vigilance on the part of an inmate, increased vigilance, represented a problem. Georgia Erickson was an unarmed administrative person doing payroll duties at all material times from 1997 to 2001. It's important to understand that she was not an armed guard. Here, if the facts were different and she were an armed guard, arguably a different reasonableness standard might apply in the eyes of a jury presented with those facts. That was not the case here. Georgia had been told, according to the record, by management that she would not be in a position where she would be alone with an inmate. And she had not previously been in a situation that she was aware of where she was alone with an inmate. In fact, in her training, Georgia had received information regarding these potential problems with prisoners having sexual fantasies about female staff. In short, all of these facts to this point suggest that there was a wealth of knowledge and certainly absolute control, as the court suggests, on the part of the Department of Corrections to deal with this situation, taking it out of the American Family context, where the employer has a lot more moving parts, if you will, where the employer has a good deal more difficulty imposing that reasonable standard. Now, in addition to that, the context of this case is that 10 of, to 12 employees worked in the administrative area where Georgia was from 97 to 2001, and that all but two of them were women. All of the prisoners at this facility were men. And so there is this dynamic where it is a predominantly female workforce, all of them administrative, none of them are armed or officers who are guards. DOC knew of the increased risk of sexual harassment in a work environment where confined inmates interacted predominantly with a female workforce. In addition to that, Georgia, in this particular case, the testimony was uncontroverted, had to work late hours with her employer's permission, knowing that she would be there, just so that she could accomplish the tasks that she had to perform. All of these things set this case apart and provide the framework which the jury used, we respectfully submit, to assess reasonable conduct or the lack thereof on the part of the Department of Corrections. In addition, these supervisors either knew or the knowledge was imputed to them that in July, July 10th of 2001, Spicer was denied parole. And he was denied parole because he continued to be a risk to society, because he was not coming along in his various programs at the prison. And in addition to that, they had classified him as a high-risk individual. Now, one of the four people to whom Georgia Erickson reported her concerns on December 20th of 2001, Captain Todd Johnson, had the authority to remove Georgia, or to remove John Spicer, the rapist, essentially immediately. All of them testified that they had the authority to do the same if they chose to do it, if there was any expression of concern. And in fact, there is this reference that to Cheryl Schuchart, who had previously expressed a concern about an inmate janitor becoming too friendly, talking too much, and that person was immediately removed.
There's nothing in the record to link the parole deferral or Spicer's security classification to sexual misconduct on his part.
Directly, there is not. No, that's correct.
Indirectly or directly?
Well, indirectly, it's...
I understand that there's really nothing. His criminal record was not for sex crimes.
Oh, it's certainly true that his criminal record was not for sex crimes. But the notion here that seemed to come through to me was that where you have inmates who are presenting problems, there ought to be this heightened scrutiny regarding the potential for inappropriate interaction with staff personnel. You know, counsel properly indicated, I think, that there were a whole range of possibilities in the case of John Spicer when he was in the situation that he was in, physical assault, sexual assault.
You can finish your thought.
I'm governed by that little red light. Thank you. And I did not get to the policy issues, but let me finish the thought, if I may. The Department of Corrections takes a position in this case that it essentially gets to do nothing when given the notice that it got. Now, a jury disagreed, and we respectfully submit that given the application of the standard, the appropriate reasonable standard, that this honorable court should also disagree with the Department of Correction position and affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Cassietta.
Thank you.
Mr. Moriarty.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mr. Spicer was denied parole primarily because he hadn't completed programs that were unavailable to him at the institutions he was located. On page 11 of the reply brief, we cite the record where it indicates there was no requirement that he be, that the inmate be gone by 4:30, that instead he was allowed to continue working at the, until he completed his tasks. On page 9 of the initial brief, we cite the record where Johnson said he didn't recognize from what Erickson was telling him that he was there after hours. He didn't put that together and get that message from her. It was only later, before trial, but only later that Johnson realized, ah, okay, I can see. It must have been after hours as well. That came together. But at the time, he didn't get that notice. She did not convey that to him, that it was after hours. In Zimmerman, relied on by Mr. Cachetta, Zimmerman held there was no liability because there was no notice of prior harassment. And it affirmed that there was no liability. In the American Family situation, employees can, in appropriate circumstances, be fired, separated entirely from the workforce. Corrections can't separate inmates from the workforce in response to misbehavior. They have to deal with these folks, and they have to keep them there, and they have to have, through equal opportunity requirements, they have to have both males and females interacting with those inmates continuously. So there's the corrections can do more, and they don't have to engage in civil service protections, et cetera, but at the same time, they're constrained in what they can do. I do think that the strict liability standard that Judge Sykes noted does come out of this unreasonable risk standard. I sincerely believe that the district court didn't think that was occurring, but when you look at it and when you recognize what is happening in a correctional setting, to say that they will be the corrections employers will be liable whenever there's an unreasonable risk, or even worse, a significant risk of sexual harassment from an inmate, I think that does lead to a strict liability standard. We ask that the judgment be reversed and the case be remanded for judgment for corrections. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you both for a case well argued. And the case will be taken under advisement.